Welcome to the On Script podcast, your home for world-class conversations on scripture and theology, where you get to meet some of the best in the field. Visit us at onscript.study. Say hello on Twitter at onscriptpodcast and stop by our Facebook page at facebook.com/onscript.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the On Script podcast. This is Matt Lynch coming to you from Regent College in Vancouver. Thanks so much for tuning in. I want to say a special thanks to our producers, Jason Stark and Taylor Terzik. They put in so much work behind the scenes and we appreciate them. And also to Alan Files, who puts in a lot of work behind the scenes, especially when things go wrong with the website, but also maintenance of the website as well, as James Steinbach, who helps out there as well. So thanks to both of them. If you get the chance to share the word about OnScript, please do so on whatever platform you can do that. That really helps us. Otherwise, enjoy the episode. And if you'd like to donate to OnScript, you can do so at onscript.study/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hello, OnScript superfans. Today I have with me Dr. Garrick V. Allen, who is Professor of Divinity and Biblical Criticism at the University of Glasgow. He'll pronounce Glasgow for us correctly later. He has written dozens of academic articles, popular pieces, and multiple award-winning monographs, including the Book of Revelation and Early Jewish Textual Culture, which won the Manfred Lautenschlager Award for Theological Promise, and his other book, Manuscripts of the Book of Revelation, which won the Paul J. Ochtemeyer Award for New Testament Scholarship. But we're not talking about those books today. Today we're talking about his book that is coming out soon. When is it coming out, Garrick?
September.
Oh, can we get a bit of a wait?
Available for pre-order.
Okay, available for, the book is Words Are Not Enough, Paratext, Manuscripts, and the Real New Testament with Erdmans. Thank you for being on the show today with us, Garrick.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
And I will note to our listeners that this is an unusual episode because, A, we are going to talk about a very recent and very famous cultural phenomenon with Bible sales that is going on right now. So if you're listening 3 years from now, you might have to go Google what we're talking about. And also, we're going to talk about everything except the actual biblical texts themselves in some ways. That's the area of interest here, is not the words in the biblical text. Sometimes that will play here, but all the other stuff that is not the biblical text is kind of what we're focusing on here, which we call paratext. So this is the part of the show where we make people feel okay with their weird life choices as scholars or grad students. So how did you get into this, into scholarship and specifically into paratextual analysis?
Yeah, I mean, everything in my life has been a big accident. So, you know, I never set out to be a biblical scholar in any sense. I went to a Christian liberal arts undergraduate school in the States as an undergraduate because my girlfriend in high school was going there. And so once I learned Greek and Hebrew, I got really excited about the languages and it kind of just caught me from there. And I've been going one step at a time, wandering backwards into this. And here we are.
And did you go the seminary route?
No, I went straight from undergraduate to the UK. I did my master's degree at St. Andrews and my PhD there as well. And then I had a few years working as a postdoc in Germany. And then worked at Dublin City University for a few years, and I've been at Glasgow here now for just over 3 years.
Okay. And who did you study with at, I could guess, but at St. Andrews?
I studied with a Hebrew Bible person with Bill Tooman, who's fantastic.
Oh, Bill, yeah.
Excellent supervisor.
Bill will not let you get away with anything.
No. So I wandered accidentally into biblical scholarship and into the New Testament accidentally. So, but what are you going to do?
Wild. Okay. Yeah. All right. And any advice for people who are currently thinking about doing what you're doing for a living?
If you could do something else, you should think about that. That's not a bad thing to do. No, I mean, you know, if you love this and you want to explore it, go ahead and try it out. See what you can do. See if you enjoy it. If you don't enjoy it as a student, you're not going to enjoy it thereafter. But if you really love what you're working on, then that's fine. Scott Hafman was a professor at St. Andrews when I was there, and he would give this talk to students at the start of each year and say, you know, if you're happy pumping gas at the end of your PhD and you're happy with what you've done going through the process, then that's okay. So I'm not sure I want to pump gas, but sometimes teaching high school and having the summers off sounds a little easier from time to time, but.
Well, you know, and if you want to pump gas, you really only have two states you can live in, New Jersey and Oregon, so.
In Oregon, I know.
So you better like the rain or New Jersey.
Oregon's, I prefer the rain, I think, in this
yeah.
case. No offense.
I own a house in New Jersey still, so I can swing. So maybe you could just really quickly explain what paratext is, how it fits within textual criticism, and then maybe, you know, for stark contrast, think of a textual critic popularizer like Bart Ehrman. Where does his work situate with kind of what you're doing, or if does it at all?
Yeah, so, I mean, paratexts are everything around the text, you know, everything beyond the text itself in a given manuscript or book or whatever sort of media you're reading. So that's everything from inscriptions and subscriptions, titles of all kinds, annotations, cross-reference systems, images, I think, layout conventions, a whole range of things. And the reason that paratexts have been so overlooked for so long is because in biblical studies, and then for the New Testament in particular, the manuscripts have mostly belonged to textual critics who, you know, make collations, make judgments about the earliest readings, understand textual history, you know, make hypotheses about the earliest form of the New Testament texts as we can reconstruct them. And that's all fine and good. But by definition, text critics only care about the text. They're not very interested in all the features around it. In fact, they're generally viewed as the things to set to the side, come back to later once we have a good text to work with. But my work the last few years, I became really interested in everything else around the text itself. And this came as I was working on a text critical project in Wuppertal, you know, reconstructing a new edition of the Book of Revelation, which is coming out this year, which I'm very excited about.
I've actually been to Wuppertal. I know the town. So
that's one of few. It's an interesting place.
It is very interesting.
They would always say Wuppertal hat schöne Ecke, had nice corners.
that's a good way to put it. They have that nice railroad track path too thing there.
Yeah, the Schwebebahn.
Yeah,
the floating railway. It's very cool.
Yeah.
My flat used to look right out onto the train going by every day. So
for all of you Simpsons fans, if you love the monorail episode, you have to Google images of
the 19th century version of this, an upside down monorail.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
But yeah, so, you know, sitting reading the manuscripts all day, transcribing text, you see, you know, I came across all sorts of things that I had no idea existed or how they worked or what they were there for. And so it sparked my interest in, exploring this phenomenon across the New Testament. And it turns out to be, you know, a very fruitful place of research that people have overlooked for a long time, that's really been hidden in plain sight. And so, you know, when you explore the manuscripts, not primarily from a text critical perspective, but from a more holistic, material, paratextual standpoint, we can get a whole lot of evidence for new questions. I mean, in terms of someone like, Bart Ehrman, Bart's work is really interesting, looks at, you know, the text and the way it changes in particular. But he has a really nice article called something like the New Testament text as a window or something like this, where he looks at the manuscripts and textual changes as evidence for early Christian social history, for reading practices and these sorts of things. So it kind of fits within that broader track, you know, and reviews, people accuse me of being like a new Bart Ehrman of some kind or another, which is a high compliment, I think, but I think I'm doing something slightly different, but in the same sort of ballpark, asking similar questions.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about paratext as also windows into social histories, you know, it's funny, I have students who I try to make them buy journaling Bibles just so they'll write in them and make all kinds of notes. And I have students who just refuse, like on principle, like I will not write in a Bible. And I have to go, oh, people have always been doing this. In fact, some of the stories that are in the New Testament were actually out in the margins at certain points. So I guess that speaks to the phenomenon is they view the Bible as a monolithic, coherent, collection, but it is a singular kind of thing. And you talk about the Bible, or at least the New Testament text, as change, as kind of a form of change. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think, you know, the view of your students reflects this broader idea that the Bible is something that's self-sufficient, that is unchanging in light of its sacredness, that is consistent and coherent from antiquity onward. And that's a nice idea. But when you look at the manuscripts and you look at the history of transmission, I mean, I think the opposite is true. You know, I think the Bible and the New Testament in particular is defined by change in terms of its text, its materials, how you make it, its layout, the structure, the script, and its paratext, all the things that come along with it. Not because it is something that is unimportant, but just the opposite. We tend to update, engage with, be in conversation with the things that are important with us, and that leads to necessarily change along the way. So the fact that the New Testament is defined by change is, I think, a marker of its importance for these communities and the people who read it from, you know, the first century onward. P46, the earliest copy of Paul's letters, is in the Chester Beatty in Dublin, where I used to work. We would go down there and take a look at it. And even this, you know, third century papyrus has the annotations of later readers, lots of correctors, people changing the text, you know, stichometric notations at the end of letters, noting how many lines are in each work, and paratexts, like inscriptions and subscriptions that weren't written by Paul. They're written by later scribes and people who turned Paul's works into a corpus. So even in our earliest examples, you see these paratextual interventions that are evidence that people are trying to do particular things with these works. So, and there's a lot of weird annotations and silly scribbles and drawings and all sorts of things in biblical manuscripts. So I say, if you have a Bible, mark it up, go crazy. Be part of this big, long tradition of change and intervention.
Well, I was going to ask you what kinds of things you find paratextually in the margins there, but the stichometric markings, mm-hmm. I assume that would be for kind of checksumming as you're making copies. Is that the reason for it?
That's part of it. I mean, it's an open question. They, you know, the New Testament works get there are certain stichometric numbers associated with each one, even though in individual copies, the lines differ. There's a question of whether it actually counts line or, you know, dodecasyllabic, like 12 syllable chains or what. So they become sort of traditional numbers that become part of the structuring system, even though in particular manuscripts, it doesn't necessarily align with those numbers. So it becomes this sort of traditional thing. So it's hard to pinpoint where and why these come up. But we do know that professional scribes in antiquity got paid by the line or, you know, by the syllable count or something like this.
An accounting invoice, Mark.
Yeah, round up, I say, you know, if you're a freelancer like that. So, but yeah, these are one of the things that exist in the tradition.
Oh, interesting. So if you were, you know, if they were to find a new manuscript somewhere, probably Egypt, mm-hmm. right? And they dig it up and you get your first look at it. What are the kinds of things that you would just expect to see, you know, minimally what you're going to see on almost any New Testament manuscript?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the time period it's from. So, you know, these things develop from late antiquity onward. But if you're talking about like papyri dug up in some garbage dump in Oxyrhynchus or something like this, you'd see inscriptions and subscriptions. So the beginning title and end title of works, distinguishing them. You'll likely see corrections to the text itself, either by the first scribe who made a mistake or by some later corrector or reader.
Would corrections be in the text itself or off to the side?
In the text itself, absolutely. So, you know, crossing out a word and writing the correct version, changing the case of a noun, adding in a sentence or two in the margins or a word here or there. Like, this is all very common. You know, I mean, Codex Sinaiticus has something like 20,000 corrections across this text made by many people over hundreds of years. So you can really see the way that actual readers engaged with these manuscripts from the very first scribe who copied the letters out in the first instance to someone writing, you know, 400 or 500 years later, who still have access to this very ancient manuscript, who are working with it. So it's a really window onto, you know, textual change, but also the way that people actually read Bibles in antiquity. We have actual evidence for this in the manuscripts themselves. And when you take a look, you find some really interesting things, and you can, you know, empathize with people from the past who are reading the same text that you're reading today, maybe in a different language, maybe in a parchment, you know, handmade codex compared to a printed Bible. But people are still doing some of the same things, and you can see yourself in some of these ancient people.
It's almost Talmudic in the non-pejorative sense that you're seeing all these layers of comments, basically, and correcting corrections. And I assume there'd be a little battling sometime, like, no, this is what it actually meant.
Absolutely. You see some, there are some instances where a secondary corrector has come through and said, you know, fix the first correction and said, you lazy scribe, you know, leave the first reading, things like this. This occurs from time to time. So there is a sort of polemical aspect to it, but you just, you know, paratexts accrue over time. It's kind of like, a snowball rolling down a hill. It kind of gathers material as it goes, and it becomes configured in different ways. And it develops in late antiquity, and the work around the Library of Caesarea of Origen and Ammonius and Euthalius and these guys, these larger systems of paratexts that become ingrained in the New Testament's manuscript tradition for over 1,000 years. So this is the kind of thing where we see everything from random annotations by some random reader to large scale systems made by a famous church father that become an ingrained part of what the New Testament is.
Any childlike scribbles where someone's kid rolled up and started marking it?
Yeah, you see all sorts of things. You see prayers in the margins. There's a manuscript at the Chester Beatty, W139, is this beautiful 12th century gospel codex. And it has a random prayer in the lower margin in the middle of Luke that's from a guy called Peter the Shoe, calls himself Peter the Shoemaker, who prays for himself, his wife Anastasia, and their children.
Mm. Wow.
So you get bits and pieces of people's devotional lives, and then you get all sorts of things like little, I just call them weird little guys. They're just little random doodles and scribbles. You see a lot of people love to draw ships. There's lots of ships on the fly leaves and
lots of ships. Okay.
You know, you also get a writing practice, so people copying out the alphabet in the margins and in the fly leaves. And these places, people practicing particular letter forms. You see depictions of like battles between, you know, Ottoman soldiers and Western peoples of some kind. So you get all sorts as you look through this material. So when you think of the Bible, you think of something pristine, something solid, something unchanging. But that's just not the case.
You give the example of paratext as a form of a kind of a map for reading the text itself. And you talk about directional maps versus representational maps. And this is the beginning of the book. You start off with what I consider probably one of the most maximal examples of a directional map, which is the Scofield Bible. So I did not actually fully appreciate how much the Scofield Bible informed even things like daily reading practices, daily devotionals, mm-hmm. and like the very practices of engagement of Scripture. So how does Scofield act as a directional map for the reader, and especially in a new way?
Yeah, I mean, the Scofield Reference Bible is really interesting. I mean, it's early 20th century, written by a guy who's a former Confederate soldier and evangelical dispensationalist, and he's trying to help people, specifically addressed to men, you know, read the Bible in a way that fits in with his broader perspective on history, religion, and what have you. And it becomes this huge, huge success. But it's heavily paratexted. So you have multiple prefaces for the book, for his theology, for each corpus, for each subsection, for each text itself. And then even within the text, you have all sorts of annotations and notes that help you to read particular passages in the way that Scofield wants you to. So it's directional in that if you go along with, you play along with these paratexts, you have to read these works like Scofield wants you to. You have no choice. And I mean, people like to be directed. The Bible's complicated. It's not easy to understand. It's an ancient text transmitted in a complex way, talking about things that we may or may not care about. So it's an easy way to enter the world of the text as Scofield sees it. I mean, it's one of the best-selling books that Oxford University Press has ever published. It's never been out of print. It was the first book of theirs to ever sell 1 million copies. and it subsidizes a lot of our academic work we still do. So
interesting.
In some sense, I'm thankful for the Scofield Bible's ongoing existence, but, you know, troubled by its theology on a number of fronts. So, you know, that's high risk. It's high risk to have a directional paratext in this way.
When I became a Christian from a very non-Christian background, when I was around 20. And, so I got a Bible that was given to me, I think, that was very low paratext. It was basically just the text with, you know, chapters and verses and probably subheadings. And I was the same problem. I didn't understand any of it. And so, mm-hmm. or it didn't say what I thought it was going to say. That was the other problem. So I went and got a NIV Life Application Bible. I don't know if you've ever seen those.
Oh, yes.
But talk about directional. That thing was like telling you, I mean, and not even, there was no malintent, but it's funny because I just wanted to have things explained to me, like, what are they even talking about? And I was getting and this is why your spiritual life must have X, Y, or Z, you know? And it's like, oh, okay. So I was getting direction I wasn't even asking for. Is there, I mean, in all of this heavy directional, and I feel like a lot of study notes Bibles kind of are always slipping their theology under or over the door.
Yeah.
But is there, in your mind, is there a pure reading of, I mean, would the best version be just handing people the text without any markings, no punctuation, and letting them have at it? Or is there a happy medium here for you? Just thinking about Bible literacy and getting people into the text.
Yeah. I mean, I'm open to all possibilities. I think that's one way of doing it. I don't think almost anybody has ever read a Bible that way from the ancient world onward, though. That is not what the manuscripts look like. It is not how people read in antiquity or the Middle Ages or humanist Europe or the early printing presses. You know, paratexts are an essential part of all literature. They're the, you know, Gerard Genette, the theorist who kind of coined the term, talks about them as thresholds of interpretation. They're the sort of thing that is the interface to get us to engage the text in particular ways. And that's for every type of literature, whether it's a modern novel, a dictionary, the Bible, in any form, you know, what have you. So, you know, I think paratexts are an essential part of all reading, more or less. So when you strip it all away, you get an interesting experiment, but you have no interface with that text. It's just you, your own knowledge, and it. And having that sort of interface, that intermediary can be a useful thing. So I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with having paratexts. They've always existed around the Bible. But we need to think carefully about what the paratexts in our copies are doing, how they're leading us to approach the text and view it in particular ways, how they're helping us to interpret particular passages and what they're doing. So when we, you know, when paratexts are passive in our own minds, they can be potentially dangerous. But when we're aware of what they're doing and who made them and to what end, then we can use them in a valuable way to, you know, engage the text, raise new questions. I think paratexts are really useful.
Right. And they help situate the reader in whatever the culture of the text is.
Exactly.
Even a modern Bible tells you to what culture it belongs in some ways.
Yes.
Even the copyright page.
Absolutely. I mean, that sort of stuff is important. I think, you know, the Bible as a collection is an invention of paratexts. Without paratexts, there is no structure or feature that can turn the four gospels into four different works and put them together. You know, there are no headings, chapter divisions, inscriptions, subscriptions, commentary around the edges. These things don't exist. It's the paratexts that make the Bible a book, a piece of literature that can be transmitted to us. So without paratexts, you don't have literature.
Okay, so let me find the boundaries of what you mean by paratext here. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at a traditional Torah scroll, I'm familiar with the Yemenite Torah scroll for weird reasons. You can always visually see when you get to the Ten Commandments because they'll elongate certain lamids or so that they center the low, 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 do not, do not, do not. Would you consider that paratextual or epigrammatic?
So there's an internal inside baseball discussion about what the boundaries of what is and isn't a paratext. I think that layout has a paratextual valence. It helps you to do particular things with a passage. So, you know, when you see the way the Ten Commandments is laid out, it's an enumerative thing. You count the 10, you, you know, participate in the counting. So for me, that has, it may not be a proper paratext, its own independent thing, but it has the same sort of effect on readers. So I would include things like images and illuminations, layout conventions, script at times, these sorts of things. So I would have a much broader view than some people about what is, what constitutes a paratext and what does not.
So would like English punctuation and an English translation count in a similar way?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, yeah, punctuation is a difficult one because it's so language specific.
Right.
In our earliest copies of the New Testament, of course, punctuation is very, very minimal, if existent at all.
Even dialect specific, because as you well know, English writing versus American English writing is punctuated very differently. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, insofar as punctuation helps us to understand where a sentence breaks or where its subclauses are, these sorts of things. Yeah, I think that has a paratextual, you know, element to it. Whether punctuation constitutes that or not, I think is a complex question that really doesn't need an answer. But it, you know, how it functions is it helps us to break up clauses and sentences and larger textual structures into something that makes sense in our own vernacular. So in that sense, yeah, I think so. Because a lot of times the Greek text is ambiguous. You could split the sentence up in various ways. And when you use punctuation in English to represent that, you make a choice. And that choice has effects.
And maybe it's because I spend more of my time in the Hebrew Bible, but I feel like especially the Pentateuch uses, well, I guess all the way up through the Nevi'im, there's a lot more literary device used as punctuation. And so, you know, the repetition, the fronting, like you can almost feel it without any kind of modern sense of punctuation.
Yes.
Where I guess...
Well, you have the Masorah as well, as a huge paratextual tradition around the Hebrew Bible, which has its own structures, its own... ideas about what the text does and how it works. Exactly. So you see this sort of thing in literature, you know, more broadly. I mean, we're running a project here in Glasgow currently called Paratext Seeking Understanding, where we're working with scholars who, you know, do Buddhist literature, Samaritan, Pentateuch, Hebrew Bible, New Testament, other early Christian texts, Qurans, a huge range of traditions to explore their paratextuality, working with cognitive scientists and philosophers to run some studies and do some different sort of cross-cultural exploration. And, you know, this phenomenon of paratextuality is diffuse throughout all literatures from the ancient world in one way or another, in one form or another. And so it actually makes good conversation partners for exploring some of these other ancient texts like the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, it wasn't until I was working in Israel with a bunch of fluent speakers who all read unpointed Hebrew, like as just part of their life, that you realize even the Nikud, the, you know, the pointing of the Hebrew text can raise problems. You know, you know when someone stops you and they're like, well, yeah, if it's vowel pointed correctly, then yeah, that's what that means. But what if it's not, right? What if that's a participle, right? So that's fascinating.
Absolutely.
Okay. Speaking of directional mapping, maybe not the Schofield level of directional mapping, but you say in the book, quote, titles are microtext unto themselves, formulations that signpost to things like plot, genre, style, and themes located in their works. I would not think, like, I think everybody would be with you. And then I read that sentence and I'm like, I think I understand what you're talking about. I read on, I'm with you on it. It doesn't seem immediately obvious how titles are microtext, though, and how they inform plot, genre, any of that. So could you unpack that a bit?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, what I mean is that the titles of the New Testament works that we have, I mean, an important thing is they weren't written by the authors of these works. They're the products of tradition of scribes and readers, probably from the second, third, fourth century, who, you know, found ways to label these texts. So they're already descriptive of what's in them. So, I mean, in terms of genre, you have words like evangelion for gospel, or epistole, letter, apocalypsis for apocalypse. All these sorts of things tell you already what sort of text you're reading. I mean, a lot of the information is obvious. We know that Paul wrote the letter. Timothy is the one who received it. But what we call these things, I think, makes a difference. And the titles in the manuscripts change constantly. So, I mean, the Book of Revelation has just over 200 Greek manuscripts, just over 300 Greek manuscripts. And we have over 60 different titles for the work. And they tell us slightly different things about where it was written, what John was doing on Patmos during the reign of Trajan, all these sorts of things. So it gives you context for understanding the work. I mean, we expect titles when we come to literature, but we often, I think, just glide over it to get to the text itself. But the title plays a role, even if a very small, maybe even subliminal role, in setting our expectations for what comes next. And when these formulations change in the manuscripts, for whatever reason, it has an effect on how you might view that particular text.
And yeah, you list some titles in there, and I think we're all familiar with, you open a Greek Bible, you know, Euangelion Kata Matheon, or... But even that is already suggesting, in an anonymous text, it's suggesting this is who this was, this is the perspective they wrote from, and it's according to them, kind of like Papias's,
yep,
this is the memoir of Matthew or something like that.
Precisely. Yeah, it gives an authorial persona to a text that is functionally anonymous. And then the similarities of the titles for the Gospels draws those four and only those four into a sort of literary connection that then gets played up by Eusebius and his canon table system that, you know, allows you to cross-reference between the different parts of the Gospels. And so the titles are sort of the first step in that larger direction of putting these texts together and making the assertion that they need to be read side by side.
Yeah, speaking of canon tables, I don't think I was aware of any of those until I think I talked to you a few years ago, and then I looked at your canon tables work, and I don't know why that seemed so shocking to me, but it was just surprising to me how somebody, I don't know, I assumed it was a very modern thing. So systematizing something like the Gospels, I mean, can you see different layers of history and culture in those various canon tables and the cross-references, or is it pretty static over time? Everybody's carrying forward the same canon tables.
So, I mean, in the Greek tradition, it's more or less the same. Martin Walrath has just done a new edition of the canon tables, the first person to ever do a truly critical edition of the system. But what these are is it's a set of 10 tables that are fixed to most Greek gospel manuscripts that we have. And Eusebius, working in the early 4th century, you know, devised a way for people to make comparisons across the Gospels without breaking up the narrative themselves. So previously, Ammonius had taken Matthew and broken up Mark, Luke, and John and created a synopsis of 4 columns where the other ones agree with Matthew or have parallels. Eusebius then took this system, created numbers for each section in the gospel, and then mapped those numbers onto these tables so people can go compare across. So table 1 is for texts that all 4 gospels share together. So if you're in Matthew 7 and Luke 12 and John 17, you can go flip to each of those sections in the gospels and read the text in comparison, the sort of hypertextual way. And, you know, the different tables show the different passages that each of the Gospels share, down to table 10, where it's lists of passages that each of the Gospels have in unique ways. So it's this really complicated system, but that persists from some of our earliest manuscripts onward. I mean, this system still exists in the Nestle-Aland editions of the New Testament.
Oh, really?
In some ways. Oh, absolutely. It's embedded in the margins of the manuscript or of the edition, and the tables are part of the preface that no one reads.
My next question was going to be, should the Nestle-Aland have this stuff in it?
And it does. Yeah, it does already. It has It has one version. I mean, the Greek system's pretty consistent. The Syriac Peshitta has about 20% more sections, so it breaks them down into smaller units of comparison. So there's different ways that Eusebius could have done it, but his perception of how the Gospels fit together is really interesting. And when you actually use the tables to make comparisons instead of using a synopsis, which breaks up the text, you raises some new questions about why did Eusebius put this passage with this passage, you know, or, you know, what does it mean that, you know, the passage in Luke where Jesus talks about only the Father knows the Son and the Son knows the Father, etc., is, you know, set against 12 different passages from John all over the gospel. Why does that work? You know, so there's been a lot of work in recent years by Jeremiah Coogan and Matthew Crawford and Francis Watson and people like this to explore the possibilities of this system for interpretation. I mean, if you read the Gospels in Greek from the year 400 to the year 1600, you probably had at least part of the Eusebian system in that manuscript. And it's something we've kind of left behind, but are starting to rediscover in interesting ways.
It reminds me, bear with me for a second, but a parallel maybe. Have you heard of old pronunciation English?
No, tell me about this.
Okay, so supposedly Shakespeare does not speak Elizabethan English. He speaks old pronunciation English, which sounds has more of a brogue to it. It sounds a bit more like modern Scottish accent. So there are entire theater companies now in London that will perform Shakespeare's plays in old pronunciation rather than Elizabethan.
Cool.
And one of the things they found, there's a great little video on this, little micro documentary on YouTube, is they found that there are different rhyme patterns than you would find in Elizabethan English. And so there might be different, like Shakespeare, Bill might have been emphasizing different things through old pronunciation rhyme patterns than he was otherwise.
Interesting.
So it
interesting.
Seems like if rhyme and meter are the ways that we break up English poetry, and then that acts in some, it feels like that's a similar analogy to what you're saying here.
Yeah, I think something like this. I mean, Eusebius's system enables us to read the Gospels in a linear way. He keeps the structure of the text the same. You could read Matthew front to back like a novel, or you could read Matthew by flipping hundreds of times to different parts of the other Gospels, going back and forth. And it creates a sort of nonlinear way of doing things. He really, I think, institutes a new way of reading the Gospels across each other as a legitimate way to make sense of what's happening. Because for him, they all have the same message. They say the same thing. I mean, a similar, along these lines of pronunciation and things, you also have all of these onomastic lists and lexical lists for Hebrew words in Greek, how to pronounce them, what they mean, all these sorts of things that can preface the Gospels. And so you have an interest in this lexical translational world as well. So, I mean, there's so many possibilities when you start looking at paratextuality. It's a matter of, you know, picking what kind of questions you want to ask of this really broad material that's out there.
And these kinds of these cross-referencing paratexts then create, well, I don't want to make the claim that it creates textual criticism, but it at least creates the conceptual world of textual criticism, you know, something like Origen is doing, or the
absolutely
maybe even the Dia Tesseron is some early version of this kind of thinking.
Just to build on that, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it enables comparison. Which is the basis, you know, the main thing you do in textual criticism. And Eusebius, you know, is explicitly building off Origen and what he's done with the Hexapla, and building off in the letter to Carpianus, which prefaces the whole system. You know, he attributes the earlier work to Ammonius, who he says created a Dia Tesseron gospel, where Matthew's in the first column and then Luke, Mark and John are split up in their parallels with Matthew. So Eusebius wants to have the same tool for comparison that Ammonius made, but he also wants you to be able to still read the Gospels front to back if you want. So his tool enables you to do both without making a synopsis or a Dia Tesseron or any of these sorts of things.
You say about using paratext, like how people actually employ these various paratext. I think you're actually quoting somebody here, so forgive me. But you say, quote, written out by hand for over a millennium, passed from person to person, employed in many different ways, New Testament manuscripts preserve traces of the assumptions, priorities, and interest of those who produce and preserve them. I think maybe you were quoting someone there.
I don't know. I don't remember who.
Yeah, and the marks of a good book for me is when you read it, after reading it, you're like, oh, all of that now seems obvious. Why
sounded pretty good. I hope that was not a quote. I hope I actually wrote that.
Might have been you.
We'll find out someday.
But then you do go on to say, paratext beget paratext, which you've pointed out is like a snowball rolling downhill. I wonder, like, I just don't think most people think of their modern Bibles as preserving the traces and assumptions of priorities and interests of people. Maybe we can say like, oh, the publisher, but I think what you're making is a larger claim is that any modern Bible is preserving thousands of years of paratextual history. And most of that is subliminal or under the surface of the text, and only some of it comes to like typeset expression. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, with modern printed Bibles, the whole idea is to present people a polished, finished project that's free of interference, that is something that you can read front to back. I think most of our modern English Bibles, not all, but many, want encourage sort of linear reading. But the things that are, you know, embedded in there, the chapter and verse numbers, the prefaces, the headings and subheadings, titles, all of these things are old conventions. Even the marginal annotations, you know, the catena and the commentary in the margins, like these all exist in the manuscripts. But what we've done in modern English Bibles in most cases is to recreate them anew and have the modern editors, you know, pick what the subheadings are, pick which words go in the margins, select what images to use, these sorts of things. So we're still doing all the same things that the people doing the manuscripts are doing. But in most cases, we're just ignoring what the people who made the manuscripts did, but just doing what they did anew in most cases. So most of the subheadings you get in your modern English Bibles are made by the editors who put it together, not from the manuscripts, even though those traditions exist across the board. So we're kind of recreating the wheel over and over again. I mean, one of the things that people who write about the Scofield Bible note is that his huge intervention, he's the first person to ever put personal notes in the margins, interpretive notes in the margins of a Bible. And it's just not true. I mean, this goes back to the 7th, 8th, 9th century, these sort of traditions. So we kind of forget what came before as we remake these things anew.
Okay, so speaking of modern Bibles, we wanted to talk a little bit. We're going to seed the speed round here, and instead we're going to talk about...
Oh man, I love the speed round.
I mean, I can ask you some speed round
questions. Okay. It's all right. Save it.
We have a modern Bible debacle that has come onto the scene, which is, people have called it the Trump Bible, but it's not actually the Trump Bible. So it's the Lee Greenwood Bible. What do you make of this? And how does it really differ from any other Bible that's out there, or even like a patriotic Bible, which there is, I think, one called the Patriots Bible that I've run into.
There's a few. Yeah, I mean, so I'm of two minds of the God Bless the USA Bible.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you could call it whatever you want. That's fine. Yeah, I mean, so as far as I know, this Bible was supposed to come out in 2021 to commemorate the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And that because of its sort of Christian nationalist bent, it was dropped from a couple publishers and has now come back around through a sort of mysterious third publisher. And no one is quite sure who they are. So, you know, I don't think Donald Trump is involved in any of the production thought paratextuality of this Bible. I imagine they paid him some money to say something nice about it. But on one hand, this is nothing new. You know, the American Patriot Bible came out over 10 years ago now. It's very popular. I mean, it's very strange. I mean, Genesis 1:1, there's a picture of the Apollo 8 astronauts for some reason. And at the end of Revelation, there's, you know, an extract from Billy Graham's speech at the National Cathedral after 9/11. Very strange stuff. I mean, Thomas Nelson puts out something called the Founders Bible that has all of these same founding documents. It's over 2,300 pages long. I mean, it has the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the Pledge of Allegiance and all these sorts of things. So these things exist. There's a market for Christian nationalists Bibles, for better or worse. So Lee Greenwood's thing is nothing new. And I think in 100 years, I'll be surprised if anyone even remembers that Donald Trump said anything about it. So on the one hand, I don't love the idea of a Christian nationalist Bible, but there's a market for it. So of course, someone's going to make it.
Now, if somebody finds it, like say, 1,000 years from now, they find this Bible, they're an expert in Christian nationalism. I mean, so I a quote from the website, by the way, I think it is worth going on the website of the God Bless the USA Bible, which I think is just godblessusabible.com or something like that.
It's wild.
The FAQ section is worth the visit to the site alone. But it, here's what it contains in it. So I was a little surprised that it doesn't really have much in it, including it doesn't have a copyright page, which is why we have no idea who is actually publishing it. It says it's published in the United States, but there's actually, we don't know who publishes it or where it's published. It says, God Bless the American, God Bless America Bible features a copy of handwritten chorus to God Bless the USA by Lee Greenwood, which just the chorus, you don't get the whole, the verses or anything, just the chorus. The U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Pledge of Allegiance. And I will note, it is the post-Eisenhower Pledge of Allegiance where they've included "under God" in it, not the original Pledge of Allegiance that did not include "under God" in it. But that said, I mean, when you talk about Christian nationalism and Christian nationalist movements, it's a pretty benign arrangement here, right? Of just, and those are all thrown in the back, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I get the feeling that most Christian nationalists are not particularly interested in the Bible in the first place. And this is a chance to produce some sort of, you know, artifact or relic that reinforces someone's worldview. And I mean, it looks to me more like a grift than anything else. It's in line with, you know, broader trends in Bible publishing in America, where publishers repackage old translations with new paratexts to appeal to highly specific audiences. I mean, all sorts of teen Bibles and men's group Bibles and women's group Bibles and, you know, baking Bibles, anything you can do. If there's an audience for it, someone will make it. And you do that through manipulating paratexts. If someone has Christian nationalist ideas and they think the U.S. Constitution is an inspired document in line with the Bible, yeah, put them together. You know, so I think this is a symptom, not a problem necessarily, although I really don't like it. just personally.
I think there's a lot of people that feel that way. I think I could imagine lots of Trump supporting Christians might be a step too far for them.
I don't know. I guess we'll find out in a few months, but
see how well it sells.
The biblical text changes from antiquity. I mean, small scale ways you have, you know, the various endings of Mark 16 and the pericope adultery in John, the woman caught in adultery and all these sorts of things and small scale changes in the text. But then for the most part, I mean, the New Testament text is based on how old it is and how widely it's transmitted. It's fairly coherent, but the things that tend to change are the paratext. The framework we give it gives it new relevance for particular contexts. And this is just one sort of deformed variant of that phenomenon.
Yeah. And so we don't have anything in antiquity or the medieval period like a Hunter's NIV that you can take into the field with you and gives you notes on creation or anything like that.
No, I mean, you do have things like these Catena manuscripts, which are manuscripts of the New Testament that have extracts from patristic writers that are arranged around the margins and comment on particular things about the text. And there's lots of different forms and versions of these. They're very widespread. But you know, it's still connected to patristic tradition, to the comments of church fathers and these sorts of things, but it does connect your reading to the interpretations that go before you. So there is this sort of thing, but it's not like there's not like a Mount Athos Bible for Athenite monks or, right, you know, something like this. So, no. I mean, because the Bible wasn't transmitted in a capitalist, economy. And this is, you know, our modern Bible situation, I would say, more particularly in America than where I am, is what happens when capitalism and cultural Christianity sort of combine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to oversell the case, but even me, various projects I've worked on, several times people have suggested, oh, that kind of thinking that you're trying to get people to get their head around, you should do a Bible on that. You should do a Bible where you write the notes on it. And that was even one publisher said that, or it suggested that it might be something to do. And the suggestion took me off. I was like, why would I a Bible? What does that even have to do with it, right? I mean, it's biblical, that the stuff I'm working on, it's working on biblical literature. But I finally realized, oh, the suggestion is that's how you get this into the hands of the people you want, because everybody will buy a Bible. They'll buy another Bible, even if they have four of them. Yeah. And you kind of control their reading, which honestly made me a little nauseated when I thought that was the approach.
Yeah, I mean, you could view yourself as a new Eusebius doing a nice, benefiting humankind for 1,000 years on how to read these texts in one sense. So, I have mixed feelings about this too. Even, another Bible I wrote about in this book was the Green Bible, which came out in 2009 or something like this by HarperCollins. And it's just the NRSV Bible, but it puts any texts that have anything to do with creation care or something like this in green print. So it's a nice little paratextual trick. I have issues with it, but overall, it's, as far as these things go, it's not a bad one. But one of the people who wrote a preface said something along the lines of, when they asked me to do this, I thought, isn't the Bible just the Bible? When we mess with it, aren't we changing its fundamental substance? And, my response is, at the end of the day, the Bible is something that we make. The Bible is something that we shape and put into the hands of people to do certain things with. And paratexts are the sort of vector to do that. So, I'm not opposed to the idea in principle, has very ancient roots, from antiquity onward, this is what people have been doing, but there's a way to do it responsibly. And when you're trying to make a buck, this is probably not the best way to go about it, I think.
Yeah, and we were saying before we started recording, it is worth mentioning that Bible sales float a lot of publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Or as you said before, it floats some of our own research.
Absolutely. As biblical scholars, if these publishers weren't selling Bibles, they wouldn't be able to subsidize our poor selling works.
Right.
This is part of the ecosystem that we are part of and are things to consider and think about as well. As we continue to do our work and think about who we're going to publish with and why. And, it gives you, again, paratext opens up a new perspective on things we take for granted and as every day. It's sort of, I think for me, like paratext sort of re-enchant the Bible in a way. It gives you a new perspective, a new take, a new way to think about people of the past and the way you read going forward and about God's role and the world that we live in and all these sorts of things. So for me, this is a really useful exercise on a lot of fronts.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Garrick Allen, thank you so much for being on OnScript with us.
Thanks, Drew. It was fun.
You've been listening to OnScript, delectable conversations on scripture and theology. If this episode has brought you inner peace or lit your biblical fire, please consider a small donation of just $2 or $5 per month. Information on how to donate can be found at onscript.study/donate.